Welcome to Sightseeing Japan, the podcast where we explore the land of creepy crawlies. I'm Paul Bresson.
And I'm Jason Ealing. What's up, Paul? How you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
So I got something for you.
Okay.
I don't know how you'll feel about this, but yesterday I almost bought a plane ticket to Japan.
Yeah? Did you find really good prices or something?
No, the prices were terrible.
You were just really craving a trip?
Yeah, so I really need a vacation. It's been a while since I've taken like a week off. So I took a week off coming up in a few weeks here, and I was planning to go to Los Angeles. And I put off buying a plane ticket. I was like, well, whatever, I can get that anytime. And then I got to be like a month away, and I was like, I better buy that plane ticket. And then I was like, let me just check what the prices are for Japan. And they weren't great, but it got me thinking, I have the money if I want to blow it. There's nothing stopping me.
Yeah, I don't blame you, Paul. I don't blame you at all for that, because honestly, I must admit the same idea kind of popped into my head. Like, well, it could happen. I mean, this year is just so full of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
As I mentioned last episode, I got married, I bought a house, and I'm still not in that house. I'm still getting it ready to be lived in.
And you've been working on this.
It's so much. And the state of the world, you know, it's like everything's so uncertain. I just feel like I need to just hunker down and like get to a place where I feel safe before I plan a trip to Japan. But
every weekend you've been calling me being like, oh, we found out this thing doesn't work. I got to go spend $700.
Yeah, no joke.
Like every weekend.
Every couple days I spend hundreds of dollars at Home Depot. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. But you're getting that place nice.
Yeah.
It'll pay off in the end.
Yeah, I don't blame you. So
I almost did it, but a couple of the thoughts were, I need to relax. Like, I need a break from work.
Yeah.
I didn't want to come back and then have to work the next day to try to squeeze the most out of it.
Yeah.
And also, not only were the flights expensive, none of them were direct, and some of them were like kind of long layovers, so it's going to be like literally like 24 hours traveling.
Yeah, that's awful.
So I'm like, okay, 9 days gets cut down to 7 real quick.
Yeah. You can only do a 9-day trip if you're doing direct flights. That's how I feel anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And the real reason, though, is valuing my friendships. Like, I told my friends in LA I was coming to LA.
Were you also thinking about our relationship and thinking that I would never forgive you if you went to Japan without me?
I was a little bit worried about what you'd say if I said, I bought a plane ticket in 3 weeks. You can't possibly come with me. I'm going to Japan without you.
I would be very jealous. But like I said, I would understand. And I think it's important, actually, that we take a moment to clarify this about our friendship. You know, are we okay with doing that? Like, can either of us book a trip to Japan without consulting the other or inviting the other? Is that something we're both okay with?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely not going to ruin our friendship. Like, barring weird circumstances, like you just deciding to go over a weekend or something, like knock yourself out. Okay. But if you're like planning a 2-week trip to Japan, I'd be happy if you invited me to partake with you. But I wouldn't like be super mad if you didn't.
Okay, that's good to hear. Paul, are you free tomorrow morning to take me to the airport? I'm just kidding.
And yes, actually.
No, gotta go back to work tomorrow. Gotta make that money for all the house problems and for the next trip to Japan. But if I may go back to the house thing for a moment and also steer us towards today's topic.
Okay. I see where you're going.
So I told you about the mice.
Yeah.
And the good news, if anyone's wondering, is that yesterday I checked the traps and for the first time did not find a single dead mouse. So we're headed in the right direction. In other news, though, so about a week ago, maybe, I finally did like a full vacuuming of the basement carpet because, you know, there's just kind of some stuff from like all the showings and stuff when they were selling the house. You know, I wanted the carpet to be real clean. So I vacuumed the carpet. It looked great. 10 minutes later, I'm walking around. Wait, there are all these little black spots on the carpet. And start looking closer. Bugs, Paul, there are bugs on the carpet. So I grab some toilet paper. I go around. I squish all the bugs and flush them, and 20 minutes later, I'm walking around, there are more bugs. So now I got that to deal with. I just called the exterminator today. And these specific bugs, I've been researching them, of course, you know. They're known as pill bugs or sow bugs or wood lice. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
I'm just imagining very small bugs. I don't know.
Let me show you a picture. You recognize those?
I mean, that looks like bugs I've seen. How big are they, though? A centimeter?
On average, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So I researched them. Very interestingly, actually, they are not insects. They're crustaceans. They're land crustaceans, but they're closely related to shrimp and lobster. Isn't that interesting?
It is, but at the same time, I've always avoided really digging into what's an insect and what's not an insect, because it's just way easier to call everything an insect that looks like an insect.
Yeah. Well, spoiler, we're talking about bugs in today's episode. And the reason we're calling them bugs instead of insects is because not all bugs are insects, right? There are a bunch of, like I said, these things are crustaceans. Spiders aren't insects, they're arachnids. And then you got myriapods, you know, centipedes and millipedes and stuff. They're bugs, but they're not all insects. So that's why we're calling them bugs.
Yeah.
Even though it sounds a little less sophisticated, maybe.
So I am curious here. So I've never bought a house. With you describing all of this, I'm wondering if our listeners are thinking, what the heck kind of rundown pit is Jason moving into? Or are they thinking, yeah, that's how that goes?
Yeah, it depends. I mean...
And sorry, I shouldn't say that. It's a nice place. It's a nice place. It just needs some love. There were renters living there before.
Yeah, that's
you know what
part
happens
of the
when
problem.
Rent as a renter. Yeah. Let me say, you know what happens when renters live on a property.
You're familiar with the landlord special, right?
No, what's that?
That's where the landlord just like slaps on a new coat of paint without taping anything off. It's just paint everywhere. Yeah. You know, you got the edges of the light switches all covered in paint and the hinges on the door covered in paint.
Yeah.
You got a lot of that kind of stuff going
on. Yeah, yeah. So it'll be a nice place, but it needs a little work.
It does. It's old. You know, for the price, we could have gotten a new build, but then I would have to live so far away from my pal Paul here. So
yeah, the location's great. The size is great. The yard is nice.
Yeah. I don't know. Right now, I'm kind of teetering on the edge of a pit of despair a lot of the time, but I think once we're settled in, I'll hopefully feel differently. That's all I got right now.
I certainly hope you do.
Yeah.
I'm sure you will. Eventually, you'll have been there 5 years and be so settled in. It'll just be like the normal. And you'll know everything. Like, oh, what's that sound? Oh, yeah, that's the thing I replaced 2 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, man. The other day, I was in the kitchen by myself cleaning. And there's just this squeaking all of a sudden coming from above the ceiling. Like, I don't know, there's something in the attic that's like swinging back and forth when it is windy, you know, and there's just squeaking sound. Like, oh, that's another thing I got to figure out. That's freaking annoying.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We should probably move on a little bit towards this episode.
Yeah, okay,
here.
Bugs. We're talking bugs. Paul.
How do you feel about bugs?
Good question. I generally don't like them. I really don't like things with lots of really long legs.
Mm.
What's interesting, though, is I don't dislike tarantulas. I'm not sure why. I feel like they're substantial enough.
Well, they're almost kind of cute with that little fur fuzz they got going on.
And it's like the size of them makes it feel like they're not as creepy, crawly as like little bugs, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think I feel the same way about those big beetles that we're going to be talking about, you know? They're kind of cool.
Yeah.
Like they're almost not bugs in my mind. They're just little animals, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I see that.
What about you?
I mostly like bugs, but there's a time and a place, right? I don't like bugs in my house. I don't like bugs on me, touching my skin.
Okay, I was going to say, if I don't manage to take care of these little crustaceans crawling around my basement, and then we record and you find one crawling on you, is that going to be a problem?
No, I mean, I don't like it, but I just flick it off. Like, I'm not scared of bugs. I'm not squeamish with bugs.
Sure.
Even when I'm outside, I'm fascinated by bugs. And I also feel like they're a sign of, like, a good, healthy ecosystem. Like, there should be bugs around doing bug things.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. I mean, it's a relatively recent thing in human history that we isolate ourselves completely from bugs and it's like, okay, this is our human space. There should be no bugs here. That was actually one of the points I was going to make about how bugs are perceived in Japan, because for a long time in traditional homes, they're very open to the outside. You know, they got those sliding wooden doors that a lot of times are open because you want a breeze coming through in those hot Japanese summers. So you would just be used to having bugs around. Like, your indoors is just an extension of the outdoors, you know?
Yeah. I feel like there almost maybe wasn't as much of an idea as indoors. It was maybe like more like, I'm covered from rain and I'm not covered from rain, but you were never really separated from the air that's outside. You didn't have an air conditioning unit and sealed windows and things. Yeah.
And I mean, your walls are basically paper.
Yeah. Bugs are going to get through.
Yeah. But yeah, so I had a bunch of notes here about like how bugs are perceived in Japan, how they tie into the culture, and even there's symbolism in bugs, right?
Yeah.
How would you say that bugs are perceived in Japanese culture historically in the religion and stuff? Got anything about that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, Shinto has teachings of reverence for all things because everything is endowed with a spirit, including the bugs. So the bugs should be respected as a part of nature with everything else.
Totally.
They're not vermin to exterminate.
Yeah. I also wanted to bring up some Buddhist ideas like mono no aware, right?
I saw that mentioned a lot in reference to bugs.
Yeah. That's a Zen concept that acknowledges the transience of all things, which kind of makes sense because bugs don't live very long. They're like kind of a reminder of this constant cycle of death and rebirth, right?
Yes.
I found some really interesting quotes too. You remember Lafcadio Hearn?
Yeah.
He was a Westerner who went to Japan and was just fascinated with the culture and wrote a lot about Japanese culture, kind of introduced it to the West in a lot of ways. He said that the belief in a mysterious relation between ghosts and insects, or rather between spirits and insects, is a very ancient belief in the East. Isn't that a cool one?
Yeah.
It reminded me of this anime called Mushishi. Did you ever see that one?
Not much of it.
I really liked that one. So in this anime, the main character goes around dealing with these supernatural creatures that they called Mushi, which is interesting because Mushi also means bug or insect in Japanese. Boom. Mm. Supernatural stuff, bugs, spirits. It's pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
I got another Hearn quote for you.
Okay.
He also said that in old Japanese literature, poems upon insects are to be found by thousands, and that the Japanese have been finding delight century after century in watching the ways of insects.
Sure. That's a good quote. Speaking of poetry, bugs are heavily referenced, as you said, in poetry there. Remember Matsuo Basho?
Yeah, of course.
Basho Wayfarer's Journey.
We saw a Basho poem or reference on a stone on one of our hikes on our last trip.
Yeah. So he was a very famous classical Japanese poet. And they have Kigo, which is a phrase that's associated with a particular season. And he very heavily used bugs for his Kigo. So fireflies, for example, would be referencing summer. So he was always throwing in these bug references kind of to set the scene.
Yeah, I really like that. And I mean, thinking about, I don't know, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself a little. I had notes later on about this, but like in anime, you hear the cicadas all the time when they're kind of setting the scene in the summer.
Yes,
right?
That's so classic to just hear that. There's also heavy symbolism with bugs, which could be in clothing motifs. It could be in artwork, where you're using different bugs to associate with seasons or even with other ideas. I saw that butterflies in particular had a number of things attached to them.
Yeah, it's interesting how different bugs evoke a different mood. Like, it's not just the season, it's like a reference to some aspect of life.
Yeah, right. If you put a butterfly on something, you could be representing beauty and elegance because of the way a butterfly, you know, kind of floats around.
Mm-hmm. Japan also has a history of eating insects, especially in mountainous areas like Gifu and Nagano, where they didn't have as much access to fish and livestock.
Yeah.
That was pretty interesting. I mean, even now, I saw that there are actually matsuri now, like festivals, where you can eat insects. They serve it as a festival food.
Yeah, my understanding was that they were bringing back old local delicacies to these festivals, things they used to eat.
That's cool. I like that. But I think even these days, you can find some types of bugs on grocery store shelves, like in cans. Grasshoppers, wasp or bee larvae.
I've heard it's getting easier because they have these like dry roasted soy crickets in a bag you can buy. Or you can order them online now because you can get anything online.
So, Paul, I have to assume that eating any kind of bug is not going to be vegan, right?
Yes.
Before you became vegan, had you ever eaten any bugs?
I think so. I think I ate crickets once when I was pretty young. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you can buy that kind of stuff here. You know, near us, they have that big yellow barn. You've been there. We went there together, right?
I have not been there.
What?
Every time you guys invite me, I say no.
Oh, right. I went with our other friends.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, they sell some of those edible insects there. They got, I had some cheese and bacon flavored crickets. And then,
of course you got cheese and bacon flavored crickets.
It sounded like the best flavor.
I bet it did.
I've also seen like scorpions in suckers, things like that. There's a certain brand that like
worm in a bottle or whole thing. Mezcal or something.
Never had that. Have you? The worm in the bottle of liquor? Anyway, another thing I was going to bring up is, Paul, did you know that the creator of Pokemon, Satoshi Tajiri, said that Pokemon was inspired by his childhood hobby of collecting insects?
That was one of those things I learned while researching this episode.
Me too.
If you think about it, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, a bunch of Pokemon are...
It's out there catching exotic creatures.
Yeah, well, they're directly based on insects, a whole lot of them, you know?
Yeah.
In the very first games, some of the first ones you catch are the Caterpie and Weedle.
Yeah.
Just little caterpillars, and they evolve into, you know...
Beedrill and whatever the other one, Moth.
Something. Butterfree,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. And then there's tons more of insect-inspired Pokemon as the series goes on.
Yeah. But I have a bunch of other notes about places that insects appear in Japanese media of different sorts. Have I mentioned... I'm pretty sure I mentioned this game that I've been playing, Natsumon, 20th Century Kid. Really fun game. Basically, you're this kid on summer vacation in the Japanese countryside in 1999. And you're just running around, exploring, having fun, just doing all these things that a Japanese kid would have done on summer break then, you know? And a big part of the game is collecting insects. I mean, so many of them. There are hundreds, and they're all like... obviously real insects that exist in Japan, and it gives you, when you catch one, it tells you a little blurb about it. That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. Paul, have you heard of a manga called Gokicha or Cockroach Girls?
No.
First place I heard of this was on Instagram. I found a little clip of the anime. It was adapted into an anime. But they're these little adorable anthropomorphized cockroaches. It's hilarious. It started out as a doujinshi, actually, and it was adapted into a manga and then an anime, I guess. Anyway.
You a fan of the beast girl genre, Jason?
I wasn't really aware that was a genre. Okay. Tell me more. What is beast girl?
I mean, it's like a manga about insect girls. That would be a beast girl.
Are we talking like, is this, like part, does this genre?
Part girl, part animal.
Any animal? Not necessarily like a beastly animal. Like cat girls, do they fall into this?
No, it's got to be a little more beastly than that.
Okay. Yeah, not really familiar.
Okay.
One last thing about bugs appearing in Japanese media. Mothra.
Yeah.
A huge moth monster that appears in kaiju movies.
A bunch of them.
Famously fought Godzilla, I believe.
Yep. Right? Did you play The Legend of Zelda Skyward Sword?
No, I didn't play that one.
Okay. Because apparently a place in there where you catch cicadas.
Oh, cool.
There's a cicada catching mechanism or something.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Well, before we get too deep into today's topic, I wanted to talk a bit about a bunch of work that we did on the Patreon while we were on the break between seasons. For one thing, we made a bunch of new content for the Patreon. We did some trip recap videos. We made our special exclusive episode about Japanese erotic art and whatnot.
That was pretty fun.
That was really fun. I thought that was pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
We made some videos for our cooking series called Cooking with PB&J. We also have a really big announcement about our Patreon tiers, which we are going to be updating, and we're adding a new one as well. So when we started the Patreon back in 2023, we weren't sure which tiers would be most popular, which benefits would be most popular. We're just kind of figuring it out. But now that we've had time to gather more data on how people are using those tiers and what people want, we're making some updates to the pricing and benefits to better align with what makes sense. So if you want to hear more details about how those tiers are going to be changing, you can go to our Patreon and check out a public post that I'm making there to explain all of those details. We're also very excited about this brand new tier that we have designed specifically for people who are actively planning a trip to Japan. We're calling it the Emperor tier, and it's going to give you access to all of our itineraries, which Paul's going to talk about in a second. We have 6 of them now. Plus, on the Emperor tier, each month you're subscribed, you'll also get a 1-hour call with me and Paul here, basically a consultation to help you plan your trip, or we can talk about whatever you want. If you want to just chat, we can do that too. It's your time to use however you like. And this new tier basically pays for itself because the pricing of this tier for 1 month is actually less than the cost of all of our itineraries added together. So you're saving money on the itineraries, plus you get all that exclusive content, plus you get the personal consultation. So we're really excited to start offering that.
And just as a note on that, we're limiting that Emperor tier to just 2 people per month because we're both busy guys. We only have so much time to be able to set up these one-on-one voice calls. So keep that in mind if you want to snag one of those.
Paul, what can you tell us about these itineraries? Because we're pretty excited about those too, right? We spend a lot of time on those.
Yeah. The ones we did for Tokyo, Kyoto, and Osaka have seemed to be popular. And we're glad that people are using those. So we wrote a few more between seasons here. So we now have a 3-day Hiroshima and Miyajima itinerary and a 2-day Nikko itinerary. And then we also now have a 2-day Nara itinerary. And I just want to highlight that one quickly today. I'm really excited about it because Nara is such a cool city. It's so iconic to go there, see the bowing deer, explore Nara Park. You've got all these 1,200 plus year old temples with these amazing artifacts. But the itinerary also brings you to a different part of the city that kind of came from a different age of the city and lets you experience some crafts and a little bit more recent stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of people go to Nara and just see the deer and see some temples and that's it. But I'm really proud of these itineraries because we're digging so much deeper than that. I think you're going to get a much more rich experience using our itineraries. And, I think these itineraries are much more solid than the itineraries that I've ever made for any of my trips even. Because, like, we've been to these places. We know a better way to put things together than we did when we first went there.
Yeah, we dug deep. We've got Google Maps links to every place you're going to go. We've got summaries of why is this place important or what are the things you should look for while you're here.
Yeah, and for a lot of the itineraries, we have links to entire podcast episodes that we did that are relevant to the places you're going. So like as you're on the train to a certain destination, you can learn all about it on the way.
Yeah. So we're pretty proud of these. If you want to go check them out, they're available on our Patreon. You don't have to be an active patron to be able to go into the shop and purchase an itinerary if you want to do that.
Yep. You can find a link to our Patreon in the show notes of this episode or on our website, sightseeingjapanpodcast.com. Paul, you ready to start talking about some bugs, like specific bugs?
Man, I can't wait to talk about some of these bugs.
Me too. This was fun. So we kind of sorted these bugs into categories, and I think we're going to start with some of the most famous bugs, right? Ones you've probably heard about.
Yeah.
They're a pretty big deal.
They're a big deal in Japan.
Yeah. So I already mentioned in the intro, like if you've watched an anime about school life, especially, I feel like they always have these establishing shots outside the school, right? They just show the school and the surrounding woods or whatever. It's summer. You see that big blue sky. And what do you hear?
Cicadas.
Bzzz, just nonstop, real loud. That's what summer's like in Japan, apparently. Cicadas are known as semi in Japan. It's a Japanese word for them. Should we describe them first, what they look like?
Yeah. I mean, to me, they almost look like a cross of a big horsefly and a grasshopper. Kind of like the size is in between those two. It's got big, clear wings.
I feel like they're bigger than most grasshoppers. They're like broad, too. They got chonky bodies, you know what I mean?
Maybe.
I guess it depends. They're normally 1 to 2 inches long, from what I saw. They got these eyes set wide apart, and they have short little antennae.
Yep. Man, bugs are so funny. Like, I didn't know some of this stuff. Like, the fact that a cicada's got two different big compound eyes, and then they have three other smaller eyes on their forehead right in between them.
Bug eyes are weird, man.
Like, I don't know what it means. I don't want to get too into it, but I was just like, whoa. That's so different.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I really had a problem keeping my notes short on this one, because for each of these bugs, like, you could do a whole episode on their biology and how, you know, weird and fascinating they are. Bugs are just, they're pretty interesting when you look into it.
Yeah.
So what would you say are, like, the cicada's most notable qualities? We already talked about the sound that they make, right? I think that's the big thing. I have some notes on that. Did you know that different species have different calls?
I learned that.
I mean, it makes sense. If you're looking for a lady cicada, you don't want one to show up that's a totally different species, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I can't mate with you. Maybe we can have some fun and, like, go out to dinner or whatever, but, like, I don't see this working out long term, you know what I mean?
Did you see the sound referred to as cicada drizzle?
No.
Because it supposedly sounds like the falling rain?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, which I could see a little bit.
What I saw is that there are people that are, like, real into cicadas. Cicada otaku, you could call them.
Okay.
And they can actually identify the different species by their call. It's like bird watching, but they're cicada listening.
Well, I'm just saying, like, that's like, that'll be going hiking with my brother in a couple of years. You know, we're hiking now, and he's like, oh, that's an oak tree. That's this, you know. Oh, that's a blue-bobbed whatever bird.
So he started out with birds, didn't he?
I think so.
And he's kind of going more towards trees these days?
He's into mushrooms a bit, too.
Now. Oh, that's true. Yeah, we
talked
about
trees
that.
And mushrooms, but still birds.
Yeah. That's cool.
It's only a matter of time before it's insects, too.
I need to get him to teach me some more stuff about that. That was fun when we went on that hike and he was pointing out trees. I need to know more about that stuff.
I know. He's so nerdy about it, but I love it.
Yeah. Paul, did you know there are over 3,000 species of cicadas in the world?
Yeah, that's crazy.
You know how many are in Japan, though?
No.
Only about 30 of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Another really interesting thing, I think, about cicadas is their life cycle. You know how that works?
I read about it, but I didn't take notes.
Well, they spend most of their lives underground.
Yeah.
Like when you see them on trees and stuff, that's when they're adults and they came out to sing and look for mates.
I think I saw that with a lot of bugs where they lived as like a larva or something for like 3/4 of their lives and then emerge and mate and die.
Yeah, it's weird. They're weird things. But another thing, I remember hearing about this as a kid. Different species of cicadas live for different amounts of time. Like I said, they have that weird life cycle, but some only emerge from the ground every 17 years.
That's wild.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Those ones aren't in Japan, though. I'm pretty sure they're not in Japan. Most species in Japan have life cycles of around 2 to 3 years. So hearing that, you might think, well, then wouldn't you only hear the cicadas singing every 2 to 3 years? But no, because there are all those different species that have different life cycles, you know?
Yeah, they're all on different timing.
Yep. Do you know where cicadas are found in the world?
They seem to be pretty prevalent. I saw tropical and temperate areas worldwide, including deserts, grasslands, and forests.
They're pretty hardy.
Yeah.
I saw every continent except Antarctica has cicadas.
That's pretty good.
So let's tie it back to Japan. What's the cultural significance of cicadas?
I mean, I don't know what makes it uniquely Japanese. I just know that the Japanese, it's just so symbolic in Japan. It's just so tied to summer.
Yeah, a symbol of summer, for sure. They're the soundtrack of summer. And they're used that way in all sorts of media. They can also be associated with childhood because they're a popular insect to catch. And that's going to be a common theme throughout this episode, is that bug catching is a big thing. As I mentioned in that video game that I've been playing, bug catching is a big thing.
Did you do some bug catching as a kid?
Maybe a little bit, not a lot. You know what I do remember? Okay, elementary school, out in the yard at recess. We went to the edge of the yard where the grass grew really tall, and there was this big, it looked like a big loogie hanging from this leaf.
Yeah.
And we're like, did somebody just spit there? And somebody's like, maybe that spit bugs. Have you heard of spit bugs?
Yeah.
So we like got these styrofoam cups and grabbed the spit and put it in the cups, and it's like, well, we'll wait and see what happens. And if nothing happens, it's probably spit. And if something happens, maybe it's bugs. And like the next day, tons of little bugs crawling all over the classroom.
That's great. Little scientists.
Yeah. Another piece of cultural significance with cicadas is that that lifestyle is, again, a symbol of transience and ties in with Buddhist ideas of rebirth. They also molt. They shed their exoskeleton, which also relates back to rebirth. If you look around, like, you can find those little shells on the ground, because after they emerge from the ground, they just wiggle out of their little exoskeletons, you know?
Yeah.
The next bug is pretty famous and kind of terrifying, but also kind of awesome. The Japanese giant hornet. The Japanese word for that is osuzumebachi. Do you know what that means, Paul?
No.
That means sparrow bee. Like a bee as big as a sparrow.
It's the size of a sparrow. Okay.
I think one of the biggest reasons that they're so well known is because they're huge and terrifying. Giant is in the name, you know? They are one of the most dangerous insects in Japan. They're intimidating and aggressive, and they fly, so you can't escape from them. I talked about this on our trip recap episode when I hiked part of the Kumano Kodo. I ran into some of these, and they're scary, man.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking, what, like 2 inches or almost 2 inches long?
Average size is 1.5 to 2 inches.
That's sad. They're like over half a finger size, kind of.
Yeah, and they're not like skinny. They're thick.
Yeah.
I like to call them murder blimps. That's what they look like.
They look like other hornets I've seen, just so much bigger.
I feel like, you know, normal hornets are, they're yellow and black, but normal hornets are kind of a lemon yellow. These things are kind of more orangish, which to me makes them somehow scarier. Like the orange makes me think they're really angry.
Mm. I feel like for me, it's like yellow is like standard, like wet floor caution. Orange is like nuclear radiation caution.
Yeah. It just makes them feel more dangerous somehow.
Did you see any stats on how many people they kill in Japan every year?
Yeah, around 50 people die from giant hornet stings each year.
That's kind of a lot. I think that makes them the most deadly animal in Japan.
Is that right?
I think I saw that.
Okay.
But what else would kill more than that?
I don't know. But yeah, they are, I mean, their venom is toxic. They're venomous. Like, they don't just sting you. You know, they inject toxic stuff into you. Their little stingers are huge. Most of those types of animals, you don't really see the stinger. They're so small. They're like little needles. But these things are like thorns on their butts. And even if you don't die from their sting, it's going to be very painful and can cause tissue damage and allergic reactions. I think actually most people that die from the stings is because of the allergic reaction. People go into anaphylactic shock when they get stung.
Yeah.
But I guess the good news is that they're generally not aggressive towards humans unless they're provoked.
Yeah, don't disturb their nest.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, they live almost exclusively in nests burrowed in the ground.
Hmm. That kind of makes them scarier too, because
yeah, they just come up out of the ground all over you.
You're looking around at the beautiful nature, and then you just happen to step on a hive or whatever.
Just your
nest.
Luck.
Nest, not a hive, right?
Yes.
Bees have hives.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know how to avoid them? I found some tips.
No.
So one, do not swat at them, obviously. You don't want to provoke them. You're just supposed to calmly leave the area. So yeah. Don't panic either. You know, if you just start flailing your arms around, that's going to be a bad idea. I also saw that dark colors like black and navy blue can make the hornets more aggressive, which is why I made sure I was very gray, like light gray, when I was hiking that trail.
Okay.
I do have a favorite fact about these things.
What's that?
I've told you about this before, but so they prey on bees. Like, yes. A few of these things will go find a beehive, and they just start murdering them. They start biting their heads off, literally. And there will be a pile of bee corpses on the ground near the hive. It's horrific. But the bees are really smart, and they have a good defense mechanism. So a bunch of bees, they just, like, smother the wasp. They just cover it, and then they just buzz their wings so fast that it heats up this little bee ball that the hornet is in the middle of, and the bees can survive higher temperatures than the hornet. So they just heat up the hornet until it boils to death, basically.
That's crazy.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, that's so cool.
Man, bugs are so cool, even though they're gross. These wasps don't only prey on bees, though. They also will feed on beetles, mantises, caterpillars, other wasps. Do you know where they're found?
They live in forests and low in mountains, but they don't like the higher altitude.
Okay. I saw they're native to Japan and other parts of Asia, and even parts of Russia. And you would hope that they would stay there, but I saw that in recent years they've been found in the Pacific Northwest of the United States.
I saw that too, but I thought they'd stamped them out now.
Oh, have they?
Yeah, they haven't seen one in a few years, as far as I understand.
That sounds like good news.
Yeah.
All right. What's the cultural significance of these things?
They're scary.
They're a symbol of strength. And their larvae have been used in traditional medicine and cuisine for a long time.
Okay.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
There's even, this is crazy, Paul. There's even a certain protein that the larvae regurgitate that is sold as a performance enhancer for athletes.
Oh, what?
Can you believe that?
That's wild.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. Another famous bug. Again, you will see these in anime a lot. The firefly. What's the Japanese word for firefly?
That's one of the ones I didn't get in Japanese.
It's Hotaru, which is also a really common name for girls, which I think is pretty cool. Isn't that a nice name? Firefly?
Firefly?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. They're a type of winged beetle, and there are over 2,000 species of them in the world.
Yeah.
And they're found in temperate and tropical regions on every continent except Antarctica.
Yeah.
Even have them here.
We definitely do. Although I have less than ever, I feel like, you know. I think their populations are shrinking a lot, have been for decades.
Could be.
But yeah, if they're not lighting up, they mostly, you know, they're just little black beetles. They're not very exciting, but it's when they get horny.
Yeah.
They light their butts up because they're looking for mates.
Yeah. The males fly around and blink their lower abdomen light source. And if they blink the right pattern or something, the female realizes it's the same species and then blinks back at them. And then they find each other.
Pretty romantic.
Also very tied in with the Japanese perception of summer, as that's when they tend to be prevalent.
I just had this silly image in my head of a bunch of humans walking around with flashlights in the dark. Flashing at each other. Hey, you look pretty good.
One of my, I'll say my favorite firefly fact.
Yeah.
Is that you think they'd be a big target flying around flashing light.
And like bats or something?
Yeah, they are. But they secrete toxic drops of blood that are really foul tasting.
Firefly blood?
Yeah.
Not red blood.
Yeah, some sort of firefly blood. So if they get eaten, they taste nasty and they're toxic, so they don't get targeted.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's a good idea. Smart little bugs.
Yeah.
So I have some stuff about cultural significance. As you said, they're a symbol of summer. They generally appear from the beginning of June to the middle of July, which is the rainy season in Japan. So firefly viewing is actually a traditional summer activity that goes back centuries. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Also, in traditional poetry, did you know, Paul, that they're often used as a metaphor for love? They're one of the most romantic bugs, I think.
Yeah, I see that.
But they can also symbolize war, with each little light representing the soul of a soldier who died in combat.
Ooh.
That reminds me of the cherry blossoms. You know, each petal is the soul of a soldier, that kind of thing. Paul, this is going to blow you away if you didn't find this.
Yeah.
Did you get through your Firefly notes already?
I said most of what I wanted to say.
Did you know that the two most common species of firefly in Japan are called the Heikei firefly and the Genji firefly?
No.
Do those words ring a bell? Heikei and Genji?
Not Heikei. I mean, Genji, Tale of Genji.
Heikei and Genji are named after the two clans that fought in the Genpei War in the Heian period, the Taira and the Minamoto. Heikei and Genji.
Okay.
Isn't that cool?
That's cool.
And last thing I had about fireflies is, of course, I have to mention the incredible Studio Ghibli film, Grave of the Fireflies.
Sure.
Where you could say, actually, that the fireflies symbolize both love and war. You know what I mean?
I do.
I gotta say, like, if you haven't seen that movie and you like incredibly sad and poignant films, it's incredible. I mean, it's an experience. It's a movie that you will not forget.
Yeah, I think I said last time we talked about this, it's a great movie, and I never want to see it again.
I think a lot of people have that feeling, but it's definitely worth the watch. All right, another famous bug. We actually have two of them. We're kind of grouping them together, right? The stag beetle and the rhinoceros beetle. So in Japanese, the stag beetle is referred to as kuwagatamushi, which means pincer-shaped bug. It's got these giant pincers on the front. And then the rhinoceros beetle is known as kabutomushi, samurai helmet bug, which is kind of awesome.
I can see that.
Yeah.
So they're huge beetles that can grow up to 6 inches long, which is 15 centimeters.
That's the rhinoceros beetle. I saw the stag beetle usually only gets up to 4.5 inches.
Sure, sure. They're herbivorous insects, and most are black or gray or maybe a little greenish in color. I feel like I see a lot of black, though.
Yeah, for sure. They might be kind of like iridescent as the light flashes over their carapace. You know what I mean?
Yeah. They're sometimes nicknamed as Hercules beetles.
Which one is that?
I think that's the rhinoceros beetle because they're so strong. They can easily fling something that's 30 times their own weight.
It's pretty amazing. Like the male rhinoceros, we should specify that it's only the males that have the really kind of noticeable characteristics. The stag beetle males have those giant pincers on their faces, and the male rhinoceros beetle has a giant horn like a big rhinoceros.
Yeah.
Although it's not pointy at the end. It's got kind of a little fork kind of thing, right? But the females are smaller and boring looking.
They're actually common as pets in Japan.
Yeah, I found some interesting stuff about that. So like catching them is a pastime for kids. People like to just go search for them. But Paul, did you know that some people catch them to enter them in wrestling competitions?
Yes.
I saw that wrestling is a more recent development than people just keeping them as pets. But you just throw two beetles in a ring and let them flip each other over and see who's able to flip the other one, right?
Yeah, it seems to be kind of sumo type rules where like if one pushes the other out of the ring, it wins.
Hmm.
Or if it flips the one off its feet, it wins. Or if one of them even walks out of the ring, it loses.
Okay.
But they're all a little different. But bug fighting has become more and more popular because it's finding an audience online. You could find bug fighting streamed on YouTube or other live stream channels.
Paul, I'm kind of curious about your opinion on this. Like, how would you compare this to cockfighting or dog fighting?
I'd say, I mean, it's definitely in the same vein. As far as I could tell, it's not as gruesome. I mean, they claim that the beetles don't get hurt. They're like, it's rare when one dies. Well, I'm like, dying sometimes isn't good. But I think they... My best guess is they don't get as hurt as much. Like two dogs tearing each other up is pretty freaking brutal.
Yeah.
But
makes sense.
Yeah. So this is like not good, but not quite in the same category.
Yeah. I have a less than fun fact for you about that whole bug fighting thing.
Okay.
So apparently populations of big beetles like these ones have been declining worldwide, and one of the leading causes for that is apparently people are poaching and smuggling these beetles to Japan because there's so much demand in Japan, both because of the bug fights and also because of the people keeping them as pets. But like everybody wants these beetles, and certain beetles from other parts of the world live a lot longer than the Japanese variants.
I saw some beetles selling for thousands of dollars.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, I guess if you're smuggling these things from Brazil or whatever, you want to make your money on them, right?
So I was all excited researching, learning about these bugs. And then I read that the top demographic for the insect trade in Japan is men in their 30s and 40s.
Huh.
I was like, oh, that's me. Like, am I in my bug phase right now?
How did they get that stat, though? Maybe that's just dads buying them for their kids, you know?
Could be. Yeah, it could be.
I don't know.
Sounds like a job for dad. I don't know if you'd send mom to go buy a bug.
Oh, that's totally like a father-son bonding thing.
Yeah.
Not that girls can't be into bugs, too. There's nothing wrong with that. Last note I had about those big beetles is that those are another symbol of summer in poetry.
Sure.
Ready to move on to another famous bug, Paul?
Sure.
So silkworms, of course, very famous in Japan. Silk was a big industry in Japan for a long time. In Japanese, silkworms are known as kaiko, or I think more commonly, kaiko-sama. These are the only bug that gets the honorific sama.
You make that much money, I guess you get respect.
I guess. What do you think of silkworms, Paul? They're pretty cool, right?
Yeah, I like silkworms.
I don't know. I'm remembering like being in parts of Japan where they made a lot of silk and they raised a lot of silkworms and they had displays about their life cycles. And they're really interesting little bugs, you know? I feel like we could do a whole episode on, I mean, I think actually on our list of ideas, silk is on there because I think that would be a really fun episode to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the silkworms, obviously these are the bugs that silk comes from. The worms themselves are the larval stage of the silk moth, and the worms make these cocoons. And the way they turn it into silk is they boil the cocoons and unwind the threads and turn it into silk thread and then weave it into the fabric.
So all these silkworms are never getting to become moths because they get in the cocoon stage. They kill them, they unwind the silk. That's how we get silk.
I think I saw there actually is a way to harvest the cocoons without killing the worms.
Okay.
But probably less
expensive.
Common.
Yeah.
So, of course, silk, as I mentioned, was a major industry in Japan, especially between the 1890s and 1960s. A lot of farmers supplemented their incomes by raising silkworms inside their homes. In Takayama, right, Paul, we were at that architectural museum where they had the Gasho Zukuri farmhouses, and they had some stuff about silkworms there, right?
Yep, they raised them, and that's what they did in the winter, you know?
I saw a lot of that kind of stuff in Shirakawa-go, too.
Yeah.
Same kind of culture there. Also, remember when we explored the ice caves at the base of Mount Fuji, they talked about how they used to store the silkworms down there until they were ready to harvest the cocoons, I think.
Mm.
The cold, like, kind of stalled their development, so they didn't fully metamorphosize or whatever.
Yeah.
Here's the most surprising fact I found about silkworms, Paul.
Yeah.
The species that they use to make the silk, it was domesticated thousands of years ago, and it can no longer survive in the wild.
I saw that they've made a ton of changes to it. Like, they're bigger, they grow faster, like, they did all these things to increase the silk production. So I guess that doesn't surprise me that
the adult moths can't even fly anymore.
Oh, man.
And the larva can't climb trees to get to their main food source, which is mulberry leaves.
Yeah.
So they're entirely dependent on humans for their survival. Like, people have to just toss a bunch of worms onto a pile of mulberry leaves or they would all die out. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I mean, it's like sheep. The way their wool grows, they would just, their wool would just keep growing and get matted, and they'd die if they wandered in the wild now.
I was thinking about the chickens that have been bred to have such massive breasts that they can't even breed anymore. Like the parts don't fit together anymore.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, there's some wild stuff out there.
All right, so those were our real famous bugs. Now let's talk about some bugs that are associated with particular seasons. And we already mentioned those famous bugs are associated with particular seasons too themselves. But Paul, in the intro, you mentioned the Kigo, right? The phrases that are associated with a certain season in poetry. So Paul, what's like a really big symbol of spring? I guess you already mentioned this bug earlier.
Yeah, I think butterflies are a nice symbol of spring.
Sure. Known in Japanese as cho.
There are many butterflies in Japan, but I did see there's a national butterfly of Japan.
Oh, yeah? What is it?
The Sasakiya charonda.
What does that look like?
The outer wings are black, and the inner wings are like a midnight blue, and then there's white spots all throughout the wings. It's really beautiful.
Sounds like it. I bet I caught one of those in my video game that I'm playing.
Probably.
So, butterflies associated with renewal and warmth and blooming flowers like cherry blossoms, all very spring-related ideas.
I saw that two butterflies together is a common pattern on wedding kimonos. Because it symbolizes like love and bliss.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they definitely appear on kimono a lot. Also in ukiyo-e prints, woodblock prints, family crests also might include butterflies a lot. I thought this was cool. They're often used as a symbol of womanhood and a successful marriage. I guess that ties in with what you said, the marriage thing. So they might appear more commonly on women's kimono and yukata. And along with dressing up in a kimono, there are even ways of doing your hair or tying your obi in a way that's supposed to be reminiscent of the butterfly's wings.
Okay, that's cool. I could definitely see the obi knot looking like a butterfly.
Yeah. And what about the idea of metamorphosis? That's got to mean something, right?
Yeah, I think that ties back into those Buddhist ideas of the cycle of life.
Sure, definitely, yeah. Life and death. I saw sometimes butterflies can represent the souls of the dead, going back to... similar to fireflies.
Okay.
But also the idea of metamorphosis is related to the idea of a girl becoming a woman. Another reason it would appear on women's kimono.
Yeah.
Because as we all know, women are more beautiful than men. Like the butterflies, right?
You said that on me.
That was a joke. Half joke. I mean, in my
opinion. So you're saying women aren't beautiful,
no,
bro?
No, I'm not. What?
Now everyone's mad.
Everybody's beautiful? Is that what I'm supposed to say?
That's just objectively not true.
All I can do is share my opinion. I think women are more beautiful than men, usually.
There you go.
But you know, I can acknowledge that Brad Pitt in Fight Club, like, wow, right? Or who else? Let's see. Brendan Fraser in The Mummy? I mean, come on.
Okay.
Okay, we're getting off course here. Okay, we talked about, what was that? Summer? Spring? Butterflies
spring.
Were
spring.
Spring. What is a good symbol of fall?
Dragonflies.
Known as tombo.
Tombo. I like that.
I do too. That's a fun word. Paul, you know how many species of dragonflies there are in the world?
Thousands.
About 3,000 from what I saw. But how many are in Japan?
I don't know.
Around 190 species.
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot. I've seen so many different dragonflies.
Do you like dragonflies?
I do, because they eat mosquitoes, and they don't bother me.
That's a good reason to like them.
Yeah.
They're like hunter bugs, you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's why they're associated with samurai in Japan.
That makes sense.
Because they're aggressive hunters that head straight for the prey. I even saw they're incapable of flying backwards. It's just to the prey.
They're incapable. I was thinking of them as like little helicopters that can go in any direction. That might be what makes them such good hunters.
Apparently, they can't fly backwards. They can hover, but not fly backwards.
All right. Well, okay, so they're associated with fall, which means they're also linked to cooler temperatures, rice harvest season, and the transition. Like that transition from summer to fall is important. So that makes the Dragonfly is very common in poetry, traditional art, and kimono. I have some more notes about their association with samurai, too.
Yeah. Did you see the dragonfly helmets?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are so cool.
Pretty cool. I have a haiku for you.
Okay.
This is from Yayu Yokoi, who is a samurai and a poet in the 1700s. Ready?
Yeah.
A dragonfly settles down to sleep on the rod of an unskillful angler.
Okay, paints a scene.
Isn't that fun? Like the unskillful angler, this guy isn't catching anything, so the dragonfly is like, oh, this rod isn't moving.
Yeah.
I can sit here and rest for a while. Okay, so in samurai times, they called the dragonfly, instead of tombo, they would often call it katsumushi, which means victory bug. Because they're such good hunter bugs. They always win. It's a symbol of victory because of its agility and apparent fearlessness. They lock onto their target and never waver. They're just like the perfect predator.
Yeah.
And that's why they can appear on samurai helmets.
They're also very associated with rice because they love those aquatic environments. So they're always heavily around the rice fields.
Cool.
And they probably eat the other bugs that are trying to get to the rice.
Yeah, I would think they would be a good sign for the rice farmers, right?
Yeah. Japanese parents have also traditionally viewed dragonflies as protector of children.
Huh.
Probably because there aren't mosquitoes around if there are dragonflies hovering, so your kids aren't going to get malaria or whatever disease from them.
That's cool. So I mentioned that other word for dragonflies. There's an even older word that they used to use for dragonfly, which is akitsu. And the Kojiki, remember that real old Japanese kind of historical mythological text from the 7th century or so? It actually calls Japan Akitsushima, Dragonfly Island, because supposedly the mythological first emperor of Japan, Emperor Jimmu, climbed a mountain and looked down at the country and said that Japan looked like a dragonfly.
Okay.
Gotta love those old legends. I feel like the further you get away from the origin of a legend, the less sense it makes. You know what I mean?
Well, I love when they wrote that. No one had ever seen Japan from space. You know, yeah. But now we can.
Yeah, that's a good point. I wonder how good their mapping skills were back then.
Yeah, they might not even have had great maps of exactly the shape.
I got another fall bug for you.
Okay.
Crickets, known in Japanese as korogi. You know crickets.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
You got them here.
Oh, yeah.
Japan's got kind of different crickets, though. You know those camel crickets, right? Those things are big and gross looking.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Wasn't one of the bosses in Haruhi?
Yeah, that's the first place I'd ever seen those. Like, what is that thing?
Yeah.
Japan has various species of crickets that each look different and sound different, but, you know, generally they look like crickets. They all got those really long back legs that lets them jump real far, right?
Yep. Little antennae in front.
Paul, as a kid in school, did you learn that crickets made their chirping sound by rubbing their legs together?
I do feel like I learned that somewhere.
Me too. But that's wrong.
Oh?
Yeah,
is it their wings?
It is their wings. Okay, it might be that there are different species that use different parts of their bodies to make sounds, but I think most of them rub their wings together. And crickets are really important in Japanese culture, right? Got a whole bunch of symbolism there.
Yeah.
So people have been enjoying the sounds of crickets in Japan for a real long time. And there was even kind of a culture that formed around the songs of crickets. Did you know that, Paul?
A culture? What do you mean by that?
Yeah. In the Heian period, aristocrats kept crickets in cages to enjoy their singing. Do you remember Disney's Mulan?
Yeah.
Mulan isn't Japanese, right? She's from China.
Yes.
But that practice, like a lot of other things, came to Japan from China, you know? So yeah, they kept their little crickets in their little cages. And real cricket connoisseurs can even identify a cricket species by its call, similar to the cicadas, you know?
Wow, that's actually really impressive.
Yeah. And in the U.S., I feel like when people talk about crickets, they're just crickets. Doesn't matter what species there are, they're just crickets, right? In Japan, though, there are multiple species that have different names that people use for them. The most popular are the Suzumushi, which means bell insect, and the Matsumushi, which is a pine insect.
Okay, that's cool.
Is that fun? Is that a fun fact? Am I going too far? Is this?
I mean, I like insects. I think this stuff's cool.
I thought it was interesting. Okay, so the symbolism of crickets. Imagine a fall evening, you're sitting on the veranda of a traditional Japanese house, right? And you're in the Japanese countryside. You're looking out across the fields. The moon is shining overhead. You hear that endless drone of the chirping crickets. What kind of emotion would you say that evokes, Paul?
I'm struggling to find the word. I feel like that makes me feel like evening, maybe, like things are winding down. It's time to relax now. It's kind of like the end of the busy day.
Okay. I saw that people associate crickets with loneliness and kind of a melancholy feeling. It brings to mind the idea of impermanence. Going back to that kind of a wistfulness. Wabi-sabi, I saw mentioned. The idea that, you know, it's just kind of the beauty of impermanence, the transience of life, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And some legends even say that the souls of the dead return as singing insects like crickets.
Okay.
I feel like a lot of these bugs, you know, their lives are so short, they symbolize death a lot or rebirth.
Yeah. I feel like it's maybe lonely if you hear one cricket. But if you hear multiple crickets, it's just like they're talking.
Sure. But the idea that souls of the dead return as crickets might be related to another fact I saw, which is that hearing crickets inside your house is considered a good omen. Like, oh, maybe that's grandma coming back to visit.
Okay, you know? Spiritually.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd be like, where's that damn cricket? I need to get out of here.
Oh, dude. I can't stand that, honestly.
They're like, so loud.
Well, for me, it's the intermittence. Like, you hear it, and you're like, oh my gosh, I need to get that thing. And then it just stops. And you're, and like, the closer you get to it, the less it chirps, too. You know what I mean? So it's like, how do you zero in on this thing? Dude, my wife has something. I don't know exactly what it is. I think it's this key that she uses at her job, but it beeps randomly. Like, there's no pattern to it, just randomly throughout the day and night, you just hear beep. It drives me insane, man.
I bet it does.
Oh, I cannot handle it.
You're like the princess of the pea when you're sleeping. Everything's got to be perfect.
Yeah. I wish I could just buy like a big steel cube. It's like 10 inches thick. I can just sleep in there.
Isolation chamber for you.
Yeah, I really do need. I already got the sleep mask. I got the earplugs in.
Yep.
All right, let's talk about some common pests you might find in a home in Japan. I was saving these for last because they're gross. These are the ones that I like the least.
Okay. Yeah. No one likes pests, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that's why they're called pests.
Yeah.
So the first one that we're going to talk about is something that we deal with a lot here in Minnesota, right, Paul?
Yeah.
Some people call it the state bird, even.
I hate that's like almost true. We're talking about the mosquito.
Known in Japanese as ka.
That's one of the first Japanese words I ever learned.
Ka?
Yeah.
What? Why?
I don't know. My Japanese teacher just like taught it to us early, and it was so easy. It was like one character, one syllable, that I just remembered it.
Huh. That's interesting. Maybe she was trying to relate. She was Japanese, I assume?
Yeah.
Maybe she was just trying to relate to like Minnesota culture. You know?
Yeah. It worked. I remember it.
Nice. Do we need to describe mosquitoes? I mean, they're pretty much everywhere, right?
Yeah, I think most people probably know a mosquito.
Wispy little things. They're real small, which makes them hard to detect until you hear that right by your ear.
Yeah.
I hate that. That's the worst.
Hum coming from its little wings.
I remember camping with my parents and trying to sleep. And this was before I started sleeping every night with the earplugs, you know? And I would just be laying there getting sleep, dozing off. Then you hear that It's just like they zero in on your ear canal.
Yeah,
and just
fly right in there. Oh, and then like the sting you, and then you got a bite inside your ear.
I hate can't that. Stand that sound. That's even worse than the random beeping.
Yeah, yeah.
So mosquitoes drink blood. The females, anyway, drink yes. blood, which is gross. I don't like any bugs that drink blood, really.
Nope.
The bugs make you itch really bad, which sucks, too. And on top of that, in Japan, the mosquitoes can carry Japanese encephalitis, which is a really scary disease that can potentially kill you.
Yes.
Not to alarm you or anything. I mean, it's pretty rare. We've mentioned it before on the podcast. If you intend to spend a whole lot of time in the Japanese countryside, it might be worth getting the vaccination, but I spent a bunch of time in the countryside. I haven't been vaccinated, and I'm still alive.
Yep.
So my anecdotal evidence, my sample size of one is useless, and you should not pay any attention to that. But maybe do your own research and make your own decision, I guess.
Yeah.
So mosquitoes, of course, everywhere in summer in Japan, which is another reason that summer is maybe not the best time to visit Japan, right? They spawn in water. And, you know, I was actually curious about that, Paul. Minnesota is known for mosquitoes because we're the land of 10,000 lakes. A lot of fresh water for mosquitoes to lay eggs in.
Yes.
But I was thinking like, well, Japan is surrounded by salt water, right? Can mosquitoes lay eggs in salt water?
No.
They can.
What?
Some species of mosquito can lay eggs in salt water.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Yeah. So what's the cultural significance?
The bug of summer.
I could not find any romantic ideas or anything attached to mosquitoes. Everybody hates them and always has. All I could find is that they've always been seen as nothing but a nuisance because they suck literally and figuratively, and there's nothing to like about them. And I actually just listened to a medical podcast recently that was talking about how, like, pretty much everybody agrees, like in the medical community and entomology community, that we should just get rid of mosquitoes. Like, they do nothing positive.
Yeah.
So many people die because of all the diseases that are transmitted by mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And like people, well, what about bats? What are bats going to eat then? Bats have plenty of other prey. They don't need the mosquitoes.
Okay. I'm not going to argue with that.
But I do have some interesting facts about the history of mosquito hate.
Okay.
So before the 1800s, it was common to use mosquito nets over beds. Or people might burn wood and leaves to create a bunch of smoke, which keeps mosquitoes away too. But Paul, are you familiar with the mosquito coil?
I don't think so.
Have you ever seen, they're almost like incense, but it's like a spiral. You can buy them here. They have them all over the place. You burn like one end of it, the outer end, I think, and it burns in a spiral towards the middle. And the smoke of this little incense thing keeps the mosquitoes away.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
It was invented in Japan in 1890. By a Japanese businessman. They're made with dried pyrethrum, which is a type of chrysanthemum, which is a natural repellent when burned. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
So I actually have seen some stuff about like early 1900s Japan when these things got popular. When they became like a really widespread thing, people could buy all these different types of holders that they could burn these coils in, right? And the most classic design is the pig. Have you ever seen these? It's like a little ceramic pig with a big open hole where its snout would be.
No.
Well, they're supposedly pig-shaped because it represents a wild boar, which is a fire prevention deity. The idea is that it protects your home from catching fire when you're burning the mosquito coil.
Okay.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, that is cool.
What's next, Paul?
Cockroaches.
Or gokiburi.
I like that one, too.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool word.
What Another you, bug that nobody likes.
Did you have to deal with those a lot in L.A.?
Yeah, they were around.
I feel like I never saw as many cockroaches as I did in L.A.
That house I lived in for the few years at the end, I probably saw every bug that exists.
Yeah.
Well, that's another bug that probably ever knows what it is, right?
I mean, there are a lot of different types of cockroaches around the world. Have you seen those, is it the hissing cockroaches from Madagascar that are enormous?
That sounds terrible.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, Japan's cockroaches probably look like most common cockroaches around the world. You know, they're black, they're kind of flat, they're pretty gross. They can fly, which is disturbing.
Yeah.
And I don't know, kind of like mosquitoes. These are mostly just gross and hated and nobody likes anything about them.
The most interesting thing I found is that they're kind of like sharks in that you can go back 320 million years ago and the fossils, they're pretty much the same as they are now. Like the cockroach has just been the cockroach for hundreds of millions of years.
Do you think it was also hated 100 million years ago? All the other animals are like, oh, those things are gross. I hate those guys.
I don't know, because I feel like partly why we hate them is because they get into our homes really easily.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Sorry, it's getting late. I'm just starting to make dumb jokes.
Yeah.
So one thing I saw specific to Japanese culture is that in some regional folklore, there are stories about cockroaches being bad luck, which, I mean, makes sense. When you see cockroaches, I don't think anyone's thinking, oh, good, this will be great. This means good things coming my way. All right, let's move on to things with a bunch of legs.
Okay.
What do you think of house centipedes, Paul?
I like centipedes.
You do?
Yeah, more or less. They're like pest eaters, you know? They like eat the other pests.
They do. But I really don't like house centipedes. Like I mentioned at the beginning, right? The legs, the really long legs, and there's so many of them, and they're so freaking fast.
Yeah.
I lived with a bunch of those in apartments in Boston, and I do not like seeing them, even if they do nice things for me. By the way, the Japanese word for a centipede is pretty fun, too. This is the common house centipede, by the way. We're talking about another centipede later, but
yeah.
The common house centipede is known as geji geji.
Yeah, that's a great one.
You know where that word came from?
No.
It's an onomatopoeia. You know how Japan loves those words that
is that them scrambling sounds? Across the floor
that's
with their
the
legs?
Sound they make. Yeah, that's the sound they make when they're walking. Geji 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 geji. Gross.
A little disappointed to find out they only have 15 pairs of legs. So whoever called centipedes wasn't a very good counter.
Who wants to look at those things long enough to count the legs?
Yeah, just glance. Oh, gross. It must be 100 of yeah. those.
That was definitely at least 100.
I don't know. I feel like most people get grossed out by centipedes because of the legs. It just doesn't bother me. I don't know.
Ugh, they just splay out. I don't know. But yeah, they eat other pests. They eat the cockroaches and spiders and bedbugs and termites. So they're not as bad as, well, they're not as bad as mosquitoes, that's for sure.
Also, the sign of them being around might mean that you have other pests. Like, they're not the problem. They're the symptom of your real problem.
That's a good point. Okay, so that's the house centipede. But, Paul, this might be... Okay, the giant hornets, scary, but I kind of like how, like, cool they are.
Yeah,
I don't
they're kind of
cool. They're cool. The giant centipede, also in my top two insect... Sorry, not insect. They're not insects. They're myriapods. But one of my favorite bugs of this episode, these giant centipedes... Known in Japanese as mukade, they are awesomely terrifying.
Yeah, I feel like I like these less in person. Like, they're just too big. They're too aggressive. I don't want to be around a giant centipede.
Have you seen one of these in real life?
No.
Me either.
And I don't want to.
Fortunately, yeah.
They fight mice.
What?
Yeah, like, they'll attack a mouse.
I didn't know that.
Like, that's crazy.
But I believe it.
Any insect that big, I don't like.
You know what? I just realized my two favorite bugs of this episode, they both have giant in the name. I just like the really big ones for some reason.
Yeah.
But so just to describe what they look like, their legs are a lot shorter than the house centipede. Like their body is much bigger relative to the length of their legs, but their bodies are enormous. They can get up to 20 centimeters long, which is almost 8 inches.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And they're thick. Like, they got this black body, they got a red head, and these yellow legs. Like, just from the coloring, you can tell you don't want to mess with this thing. It's got the colors that bugs have when they're warning you not to mess with them.
Yeah. I've heard the bite of a giant centipede hurts way more than getting stung by a bee does.
I believe it.
The only upside is there's no venom, so after a day or two, you feel better.
They are venomous, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, well, I guess it doesn't hurt humans then?
Yeah, okay, so they're venomous. They probably won't kill you, but their bite is very painful. And if you have anything more than a lot of pain and a bit of swelling, you should go to a doctor. This is the home pest that's most likely to harm you.
Yeah.
Is what I saw.
Yeah.
They also apparently have some sort of irritant on their exoskeleton. So even if you just touch them, it's not going to feel good on your skin.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Handle with care.
Do you know where they're found? In your shoes.
Oh, I mentioned that, right?
When I hiked the Kumano Kodo, I heard a story that one of the guest houses where people were staying, somebody got bit by a mukade that was hiding in their shoe.
Oh, my God.
And the owners of the guest house, they had no idea what to do because it had never happened before. I think they ended up getting the person to a doctor or something, but like, oh, man, that'd be scary.
No thanks.
That'd be awful. But they like cold, dark places, like the insides of shoes.
New fear unlocked. I always used to check my shoes in LA because I'd heard stories about like scorpions or whatever crawling in a shoe.
Yeah.
But I don't anymore.
Because you're back in Minnesota?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't either. And I don't want to scare anybody. I mean, these are most common in the countryside in Japan. And as we said, Paul and I, we've spent a bunch of time in Japan and we've never even seen one of these.
Yeah.
They can also be found in other parts of Asia, apparently, but fortunately not in the United States. You know, I saw as I was researching this, there was a website that was talking about this freeze spray that you can buy so that you don't have to like touch them or squish them or whatever. You just like, just freeze them. You just spray this stuff at them like liquid nitrogen or something.
Oh my goodness. Okay. That works, I guess.
Yeah.
Then sweep them up and
unless you just, I mean, you gotta get it. You gotta really go for it. If you just make it angry, then you're in a worse situation.
I saw the old wives' tradition was throw a pot of boiling water on them.
That would work, I guess. But then you got boiling water all over your floor.
Give it a little scrub while you're at it.
I guess. So cultural significance, Paul. I mean, with these things being so scary and big, they gotta mean something to the Japanese people, right?
Terror. I don't know.
I saw that they've been associated with evil since ancient times.
I believe
it. Paul, this has come up on the podcast before. Do you recall a giant centipede?
No.
The giant centipede appears in folklore as a yokai. And in one of our very first folktale episodes, we told a story about a giant centipede, like a really giant centipede that could like wrap around a mountain. It was so big. And it was killed by a brave samurai to help the Dragon King. The Dragon King was terrified of the giant centipede. This doesn't ring a bell at all. The samurai, he put the tip of the arrowhead in his mouth, and it was the saliva that allowed him to kill the centipede. You don't remember that at all?
Just a little bit. Not all those details.
That happened.
Yeah. Sounds like a cool story.
It was a pretty cool one. Paul, you want to talk about bugs with like not quite as many legs, but really long legs? You know, if you added up the total length, if you pulled off all the legs and like put them end to end, it would probably equal about the same amount because there are less of them, but they're longer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess that's a weird way to say it, but I know what you're saying. Yeah. You talk about arachnids?
Yeah.
We saw a bunch on our last trip.
Oh, yeah. This category of bugs, you'll probably see in Japan if you pay attention. I mean, if you're just wandering around blissfully unaware of your surroundings, you could go a whole Japan trip without seeing these. But if you're paying any attention, you'll probably see some spiders.
Yeah.
Japan's got a lot of them and it's got some big ones.
Yeah. So the first one, the one that we saw a bunch, was the golden silk orb weaver.
Or Jorogumo.
It's a pretty large spider that has yellow and light blue stripes along its abdomen and yellow stripes on its legs too. So that's what pops and kind of gives it away.
Is it blue on its abdomen?
Yeah.
I thought it looked more like black, the part that you're thinking of.
It does, but if you get like a really good picture, you can kind of see like it's a little bluish. It's like a little bluish, but yeah, it kind of looks black.
There's some red there too. I thought they were like red, black, and yellow is their body, and then the legs have the yellow and black stripes.
Oh, I had a note. A little red near the rear of its abdomen.
There you go.
There you go.
All right. But yeah, they got a big bulbous butt, and all those colors. Yes. I feel like the more colors you see on a spider, the scarier it's going to look.
Yeah, they're a big, fat spider.
Yeah.
They're native in all of Japan except Hokkaido.
And they're all over the place in the woods. If you're walking through the woods, you will come across these.
Yeah. We saw them in parks, old shrines, in the woods.
Good news is they rarely bite humans, and even if they do, they're not deadly. I saw that their bite could be compared to a bee sting in pain level.
Okay.
And they make enormous webs, right?
Yeah, those webs are huge.
I've almost walked through one of those, and...
That's how you get bitten, bro.
Yeah, probably.
I saw a pretty cool legend about the name.
Oh, I want to make one note about the name. So, Jorogumo. Gumo comes from Kumo, which just means spider. So, like, all spiders are Kumo.
Okay. So, Jorogumo was the name of a legendary spider in Japanese folklore that could transform into a beautiful woman that breathed fire for some reason.
Oh, I didn't see the fire breathing part.
And she could control other spiders. And she would seek out to seduce men whom she would bind in her silk and devour.
Nice.
So spiders, I feel like, have been associated with kind of with like the evil and the bad.
Yeah.
Even in our culture, too.
It's interesting. I wonder why that spider got associated with beautiful women somehow. Paul, this is going to be a weird question, but do you find spiders to have any kind of erotic qualities?
No. I've seen some, you know, I brought up the Beast Girl thing earlier.
Yeah, you did.
I've seen some Spider Girl stuff. Not into it.
I wonder why that's a thing, though.
I think some people like legs. I think some people have extreme leg fetish, and a spider's got lots of long legs. Hmm. That's my best guess.
If that were it, though, wouldn't you expect these depictions of sexy spiders to have, like, 8 human-like legs? What I usually see,
that'd
I feel
be weird.
Like, is like a spider body with the spider legs, and it's just like the torso of a woman sticking out of the big, spider butt.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember the game Diablo 2?
Yes.
You remember the first boss? I forget what her name was, but she was kind of like a big spider sort of thing.
No.
Okay. I don't know. I just had this weird dream about that female boss one time.
Okay. Like while you were playing the game or like years later?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I mean, this was like years and years ago. It was probably more than a decade ago, but it was so weird and disturbing that it stuck with me. That dream, you know?
I've had a few of those.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on. Okay, this next spider, probably my least favorite spider in the world. The Huntsman, known in Japanese as the Ashidakagumo, which means long-legged spider. And that's why I don't like them. These things have insane wingspans. They're huge. I always thought they were kind of centralized in Australia.
Yeah, but they have a much wider range than I realized.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty big. They're getting to the point of being like too big that I don't like it.
But they're not cute like tarantulas. Tarantulas are cute because they're kind of compact.
Yeah.
But like the Huntsman, their legs splay out so far.
Yeah.
It looks like they could just like wrap their legs around your whole head.
And the fact that they're an aggressive predator, you know, other spiders weave their web and they just kind of sit and wait. Huntsmen are like ambush predators.
That's how they got their name.
Yeah, they go out and hunt and kill and chase things.
Yeah. I saw that their leg spans can be up to almost a foot across.
Oh, man. That's big.
Although, so there are a bunch of different huntsman spiders around the world. The ones in Japan aren't that big. I think on average, their leg span would be around 6 inches, half a foot across. But that's still enormous.
Yeah.
Their color is kind of light brown. They are venomous, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't usually get very close to people, and they're most likely to just run away. And even if they did bite you, the venom isn't that bad. Probably no reason to go to a doctor.
Yeah.
Do they make webs?
I don't think so.
I don't think they do either. Okay, this is a cool fact about them. They're territorial, and they'll fight with the Mukade for territory.
Okay.
That's the Japanese, the giant centipede that we talked about.
That'd be quite the battle.
You can decide which one is less objectionable to you, and you can, you know, keep the spiders around, keep the centipedes away, or vice versa. But yeah, I would love to see a video of that, man. in slow motion, you know?
Yeah, how do they even fight? I don't even know.
Oh man, now I'm just imagining, like, that could be like an epic anime or something, you know? An anime fight.
Yeah, go make a bug anime.
There are plenty out there already. So huntsmen, like the Mukade, common in the countryside. Did you find any cultural significance stuff about the huntsman?
No, I didn't. Did you get anything?
Yeah. So there's an old Japanese saying that goes way back, apparently. Asagumo wa korosuna, yorugumo wa korose. Which means, don't kill morning spiders, but kill evening spiders.
Okay.
Apparently, morning spiders are supposed to bring good luck, but evening spiders are a sign of a threat against your home, like a burglar. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, I suppose I'm less comfortable with insects being around while I'm sleeping. I don't like the idea of them like crawling around me.
Yeah, makes sense, I guess. Well, Paul, I think we got one more bug left to talk about. This is another arachnid. We're talking about the house dust mite, also known as the Japanese bed bug, also known as the tatami bug, known in Japanese as Dani.
This one's got to be my least favorite.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to come across one of these. Because if you come across one, it's probably going to be a whole bunch of them.
Right, it's going to be an infestation.
Yeah, nobody likes infestations. Although, remember that Papa Roach album, Infest? That was their best one.
Amazing album.
I feel like they got more generic since then, you know?
Yeah, they got older, you know? Yeah.
Great album, though.
Oh, yeah. Another thing that I really dislike about them is the fact that, like, anything in your bed, like a bug in your bed or your sleeping area, is not fun.
Another reason to have a steel cube that you can sleep inside and nothing can get in. Nobody wants to be messed with when they're sleeping. That's like one thing that I'm really passionate about. If somebody messes with me while I'm sleeping, they wake me up for whatever dumb reason, there's very little that will make me more angry at a person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's annoying.
Yeah. So these Dani, these Japanese bedbugs, they're not like American bedbugs. They're much smaller, less than 1 millimeter across, which makes sense because they're mites. Mites are little. Mites are also arachnids. I mentioned that. They're not insects. American bedbugs are insects. These Japanese bedbugs, not insects.
Oh.
They're arachnids. But they kind of function the same way. They like the warm, moist places. They'll get into those tatami mats. They'll get into your futon. And they bite people on exposed skin. So, same kind of effect.
Yeah, with the climate in Japan, it's just really hard to get rid of them. They just thrive. So it's an endless battle.
Yeah. Paul, have you seen, I don't know, in anime or whatever, or have you just heard about people like airing out their futons and tatami mats on their balcony regularly?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is one of the main reasons that people do that. I mean, you know, you got to worry about mildew, moisture, that kind of stuff too, but like airing them out can help keep these mites away.
Okay. Good to know.
Because again, they like moist places. You know, you got to keep your stuff dry so it doesn't attract the Dani.
The Dani. That even sounds like a plague. I'm sorry. You've got the Dani.
Yeah. I don't know. Looking at that word, Dani, it reminds me of Danny.
Yeah.
Oh, do you remember Danny? We worked with a Danny.
Did we?
Yeah, at Subway.
At Subway?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, vaguely.
Yeah. Or like, it reminds me of like Danny California, that Chili Peppers song.
Yep.
I don't know why that's relevant. It has nothing to do with what Dani are, but that's what it makes me think of. A giant humanoid bug named Danny.
I don't think I'd like a giant humanoid bug named Danny.
I mean, like I said, the bigger the bug, the less creepy, you know? If it was a life-sized arachnid or a human-sized arachnid.
Wait, I thought we spent this whole episode deciding we don't like the big bugs. They get too big, we become uncomfortable with them.
Well, it depends. I think it's mostly the legs for me. Okay. I don't like the long legs, but like a big-bodied bug, it feels like it's less elusive, you know? If I'm trying to kill that thing, the bigger the body, the bigger the target. The longer the legs, the faster it gets away from me.
Okay, sure.
I don't know. It's getting late. I feel like this is getting weird.
Yeah, I think we've bugged out long enough here.
Yeah. Well, I hope you learned something. If you feel like we missed a really important bug that you like, or you know what I would love to hear is if any of our listeners have had any crazy experiences with any of these bugs. If you have gone head-to-head with a Mukade, I would love to hear about it. So please reach out and let us know if that has happened. You can email us at feedback@sightseeingjapanpodcast.com. You can also reach us via our website, sightseeingjapanpodcast.com, or you can find us on Instagram or X. We are at SJP Podcast, both of those places. Before we go, we should thank our Shogun-level patrons, Nicholas McKibben, Kevin Harris, Michael Morris, Wesley C., Brady K., Jack, David Imani, Susan, Tori, Shaked Rosenthal, Tina Anderson, Alexa Gonzalez, Pamela Arola, Kevin Phillips, Franzi and Matthias, Saul Martinez, Kelly Ardong, Dennis Pearson, and Robin Moore. Thank you all so very, very much.
Thanks for the support.
Well, you want to beg for reviews again?
I'm just going to casually ask this time.
Okay, go for it.
Hey, if you're listening and you like us, feel free to drop a review. Helps get the show out there to people and shows that it's cool and other people like it.
That would be awesome. And it'll give me a reason to text Paul and be like, hey, Paul, look at these very nice things that people have to say about us.
Yeah, that's always cool.
Yeah. Well, what are we talking about next time, Paul?
We're going to talk about the city of Sendai.
Cool, cool.
Yeah, that should be fun.
What do you know about Sendai?
I mean, I know a little bit about it geographically, but I don't really know what you'd see in Sendai, so I got to look into that a bit.
Yeah. I spent a couple days there with my wife before she was my wife. She was actually just my girlfriend at that time. But yeah, I liked Sendai. It was fun. I actually started looking into the history a little bit today, and Date Masamune, he founded Sendai. He was a really important character in their history. Super interesting guy, man. I can't wait to talk about him.
Awesome.
Yeah. He had one eye.
Nice.
Just going to drop that fun fact there as a teaser. Well, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.